Good day to listeners. My name is Ray Blankenheim, and I am host of On Your Scoop with Ray. This week, we're going to talk about what it was like growing up, fixing and fixing up classic American cars. When I was growing up, I grew up in a good age where we understood what the car engine was all about. And we were able to go out and find decent deals, and it was our pride and joy growing up. I grew up in Bowie, Maryland, not too far from Baltimore. And we were very much known, and it didn't seem that great to me at the time, and I really didn't understand it, but we were very much known as muscle car territory. In that way, I had the privilege to begin to participate in a network of folks that got together at gatherings in the community and experienced that great slice of American pie, which was the muscle car movement, in which we would gather at the Dairy Queen, show off what we were doing, or just take a look and see what other people were doing. And we also got a chance to go to the local raceways and dragways. This has always been a critical part of our area surrounding Baltimore and within Baltimore. It is a area in which is also evolving, and it's also an area that's very critical throughout the U.S., I think. So I wanted to talk about that slice of America and bring that into our show. To do that, I have this week's guest, Mr. Gilbert Spurlett, owner of GS Upholstery, a shop in Millersville, Maryland, a suburb of Baltimore, Annapolis. Here, I always like going to the shop. I mean, you know, Gil, I love your shop, and it always brings back memories of when we were growing up, because you go in there and there's always a couple of cool cars around. And it's always, just the other day we went, and what was it, 1952 Mercedes-Benz that you're working on?
That's right.
Yeah.
Actually, in 1954, yeah. But
okay, all right,
indistinguishable. Thanks for having me, Ray.
Sure. And also, you know, there was a classic Mustang, you know, and so there's always, I'd always go there, and then, geez, you know, after work we'd go grab a beer, and then some of his customers would come along, or some of the people that you work with through the network, other types of professionals would come in, and it was a gathering place, a place where, you know, the car community could go together and talk about the newest developments and this or that, and, you know, and experience this movement. And this has been going on since, what, 1989 you opened your shop?
That's right, August of 1989.
Okay. So, anyway, Gil, one of the things I wanted to talk about right off is, where did you get this excitement for new, you know, restoring cars and being part of that movement, and your specific profession as a GS upholstery car? When did you get that first bug? Because I was talking about it some, and we experienced some great times together, but I think you were actually kind of like in the lead with us, you know? I mean,
sure.
You're always, you know, I always look to you for example.
I can tell you from the very beginning, as far back as I can remember, playing with Matchbox and Hot Wheels cars as a small child, that turned into assembling model car kits and wanting to improve them and make them as nice as possible. At the same time, my father shared a passion for classic cars, so that certainly helped to support what was growing inside me as far as a love for automobiles and and a need to, as I got older, a need to find my career, what I was going to do for a living, and it just happened. I was taking accounting classes in college.
Yes, I remember that.
And I would get very excited when the textbook would have something to do with an automotive repair shop, and I would start to daydream. That's how it got started. I was afforded an opportunity to apprentice at an upholstery shop in Landover. The gentleman's name was Buzzy Vogel. He owned Ardmore Auto Trim.
He was always your mentor. I mean, you always would speak about him.
Yeah, he showed me how the big boys did it. He introduced me to the more adult form of the enjoyment of hot rods and muscle cars. He knew people that had been in the business for many years, decades, and showed me things that I'd never seen before. And that really helped to fuel my passion and realize that this was a much bigger world if you were given the opportunity to be around these people. You could become a craftsman and you could become a professional. And that's what made the difference for me, is actually making the transition from just an enthusiast to a professional.
Did Buzzy do upholstery specifically, or was he more of a general restoration guy?
Well, he was an upholsterer by trade, and he was very talented. So in his spare time, he would build hot rods in his garage from the frame up. He would fabricate everything. And
wow.
It's kind of funny because he wasn't much of a muscle car guy as he was street rods, typically pre-1948. I was always a big muscle car guy, but because we both shared a passion for cars, it was never a problem.
Well, where we're from, it's like peanut butter and jelly. You know, there was a Crofton Raceway, right?
Absolutely. Crofton, Capital Raceway in Crofton.
Yes.
Bud's Creek Raceway. These are all quarter mile strips. And then, of course, 7580 in Western Maryland, which just reopened. These places have enjoyed a resurgence of popularity, and with that has come a new influx of money, usually by change of ownership. And they've gone through these places and modernized them because they realize that there's a lot of people who are interested in this hobby, and racing in particular, and they want somewhere to go out and test their vehicles, and they will spend money.
So that's so cool. So they restored it to what it was, you know, in its heyday, or you modernized it while restoring it, or
both. Yeah, pretty much every end of the spectrum. You'll find anything at these racetracks.
Right.
Back when we were kids, Ray, we had these muscle cars and we didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
That didn't stop us. We wanted to see how fast these cars would go, and we would do it.
There was one particular ride that, you know, when you'd gotten your first GTO, and I wanted to tell that story because it's such a great story, and we were on the Eastern Shore.
That's right.
Right. And we freaking opened up that car, you know, because there was nothing back there. You know, I mean, just a lot of roads and farm and tobacco farms. And I remember all the leaves blowing out at us but, you know, the wind in the air and the sound of that car.
It was a 1968 GTO convertible.
Right.
And we were taking it from Ocean City to Chincoteague to visit some friends.
Right, okay.
And there's a long two-lane road with nothing on it. And we had the top down, and it was a beautiful day. And we probably broke some laws that day.
Yes. We're bad boys.
You remember the leaves coming? We had opened up some ventilation vents in the kick panels of the car that I'd just bought the car. And we were covered in leaves and dirt. And it was quite a surprise.
Yeah, it was fun though. It all added to the effect, and I remember just a few of us, but you were saying all our friends were in this car, which sounds great. You know?
I believe there were six of us, but what a sense of freedom with the top down, 100 miles an hour. There's nothing like it.
Yeah. Excellent. So this led to the Fuel, obviously. I remember that GTO. We were all so excited when you bought that and yours.
Yeah.
Fixing it up.
Yeah, it was. You know? I think a lot of people buy these cars because they want to enjoy the car, of course, but it also gives them a sense of identity. And I honestly will tell you that I wanted to be known back then. I was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be the guy with the cool car.
You were?
I graduated from a Ford Pinto to a 68 GTO convertible, and that's quite a jump.
I remember about 6 or 7 years ago, I came down to play some golf. It was a chip and putt.
Uh-huh.
And we were driving up there, and we were in one of your GTOs, and somebody said, "Ooh, cool car."
Yeah.
You know, and that's such a great feeling. You know, I mean, it brought back a lot of memories.
I would say 2 out of 3 people, when you pass them on the road, they look at it, and either they already have a car like that, or they wish they did. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm here today, is to talk about the people that wish they did and plan on having one. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually what we want to talk to, and that's the next subject, you know. But let's recap a bit how much, you know, it's just become a slice of Americana from memories, and also it's just become an emerging tradition, which leads me to the next subject, is the recent developments in the restoration movement, and how it's changed even from 20 years ago, right? I mean, you know, there's been a lot of really, things have been resurgent, and tell us about that.
The muscle car restoration world has changed in the last 20 years unimaginably.
Okay.
If you can go back to the 60s and 70s when these cars were just being built, and then there was no need for restoration parts, of course, but you go on into the 80s and people started to want to rehabilitate these cars. They still had them. They were getting a little run down. There was really nowhere to get the parts. The dealers had discontinued the parts. They weren't available. The only place you could get the parts were at these big flea markets or the very small, at the time, reproduction market. It was just starting up. The reproduction industry has just gone crazy in the last 20 years.
Okay.
The availability of parts, of course, is now much easier because of the internet. But what was difficult in the beginning for reproduction was the expense. It took an enormous amount of money to reproduce these parts. And people back in the 80s just weren't willing to invest the money back then. I guess because of changes in the economy, people with investment money would... Now we're approaching these people who needed investment funding, if that's the right word for it.
Okay. And this funded the availability of these parts.
Absolutely. These people were able to reproduce the bumpers, the fenders, the hoods, the sheet metal that was so badly needed.
Wow.
And because of that, people were able to restore their muscle cars much faster and less expensively.
Now, that's about 10 years ago, it sounds like?
I would say as far back as the late 80s, the reproduction industry really began to flourish.
Okay.
And then, of course, with the internet, they were able to get the parts out to you. They wouldn't have to rely on a catalog.
Right.
So we're talking, I want to restore my car. Literally, you can have all the parts you need in a few days at your doorstep.
Right.
Unbelievable.
So cool.
Sure.
No more scrounging around the old car wrecks and ruins like we used to do back over by Laurel, you know?
Sure, all the junkyards. We'd go to Carlisle or Hershey,
yes,
and we'd drag our knuckles through the
Yes.
The endless acres of parts, and they were rusty. It was a mess. You didn't know what you were buying.
Yeah. You had to bring your own tools, and, you know, and then you make a deal with the guy, you know.
It's become much more convenient. And that's what people want today.
Okay.
For everything is convenience. And it just so happens that the muscle car owners are enjoying that convenience as well. It's a wonderful thing.
Right. Yes, it does sound like a wonderful thing. Well, what about also what's going now with all the American manufacturers kind of reproducing the old cars?
Isn't that neat?
I think it's amazing. I think it's really cool.
If it weren't for all the muscle cars that are being restored and driven,
okay,
I don't think Detroit would have been prompted to reintroduce these cars. You have the Charger, the Challenger,
right,
the Camaro, the Mustang. The Mustang never left us, but the Challenger and the Charger certainly did. The Mustang was at some point no longer considered much of a performance car.
Right.
Detroit has looked around at guys like us, the muscle car owners, and said, hey, we're going to build these guys new cars, and they're going to buy them. And they've done a tremendous job, Ray. They're fast. They're reliable. They're a little expensive, but they're worth it.
No, I mean, they're really cool. My niece's boyfriend has one, and he got to show it to me, and I was like, this is just amazing, you know.
It's a car that he can get in if it's a late model Challenger, Charger, whatever it may be. Late 2000s to the 2011s, 2012s, 2013s. These are performance cars with warranties.
Right.
And what's most interesting, it's a bit disheartening to the classic muscle car owner.
Well, yeah, there's a kind of debate out there. And also there's new, now there's shows on with these cars as opposed to the old classic cars. Now you have shows with these cars all fixed up, you know.
Well, the difficult
it's become
pill,
part of the member or the family, I guess.
Sure, but there's a hard pill for the classic enthusiast to swallow. The fact is, these new muscle cars outperform the old ones.
Okay.
In acceleration, top speed, handling, reliability, you can get in these cars and you can drive them cross country. You can take them to the drag strip and run 12, 13 second quarter miles. They are amazing. In my opinion, they don't have the character.
Right,
they're
sure
not old cars.
Right.
But I think it's wonderful that the old cars spawned these new muscle cars.
But that's led to the new development that we were talking about earlier where, you know, where some of the pitfalls are trying to restore an old car like it exactly was. And you were talking about the newer developments in the car movement. Can we talk about that a little more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, this has to do with aftermarket products that are upgrades to the original muscle cars. Again, we have outside investors looking to provide money to people who are going to produce products to sell.
Mm-hmm.
It happens in any industry.
The new wave after the first wave.
So these guys are sitting there. They're saying, you have this classic muscle car. You want to drive it, but it doesn't drive very well. It certainly doesn't drive like a new car, and it overheats, and the air conditioning doesn't work very well. We have these products that will upgrade your original car and make it much better. It'll run better, drive better, make it more reliable. And they were given the investment funding they needed. And
that's awesome.
They're marketing these parts. And they are fantastic. The braking, the brakes are better. The tires are better. They have electronic computer management systems for the engines now. I'll tell you, in my shop right now.
Right, okay.
I have a 1967 Plymouth Barracuda convertible.
No way.
It has a late model. When I say late model, it's about a 2 or 3 year old Hemi out of a 2 or 3 year old Dodge Challenger. It has a complete electronic engine management system with fuel injection, air conditioning. It's like a new car. He gets in it and he turns the key and it starts right up. He drove it probably, I think today, about 50, well, he dropped it off yesterday, actually.
Okay.
Drove it about 50 miles in the heat with the windows up and the AC on as if it were a new car.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it from the outside, it looks like a 1967 Barracuda, and it is.
Right.
But he's done the proper aftermarket upgrades to make it a reliable driver.
That's so cool. So you could have the style, the class from the old cars, and yet have the performance of all those awesome cars that are being put out by our American companies. That's just amazing.
You bet.
Wow. Now, if you don't mind, if you could give some advice to people who, like, you know, like me, and a lot of other folks who, you know, remember the old days where, you know, we could fix our own cars and we just love the old cars and we want to get get involved in the restoration movement of a car. What would be your advice on how to proceed with that?
Well, I think there's two types of potential muscle car owners. On one side, you're going to have the person who buys the muscle car as a showpiece.
Okay.
He intends to drive it rarely.
Okay.
He wants to keep it in his garage, cover it up, and show it to his friends, and drive it on rare occasions. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the other person intends to drive their car.
Right.
Now, in that category, I think we need to look at two different types of people. The do-it-yourselfer who has some mechanical knowledge, and the guy who just has that desire to own and drive one of these cars.
Right.
And I think that's who we're going to look at first. This gentleman or woman wants a muscle car, and they want to drive it. They don't have a lot of mechanical prowess.
Mm-hmm.
They do have enough.
Not much, though. More than they think they have.
I've seen you work on cars,
well,
right?
Less than they think they have.
You still have skills from back in the day.
No,
I've seen
no,
it.
No, I really don't.
We learned
I'm
by...
Just teasing around with
there
you.
Were no books. We learned by doing.
Yeah.
And this person has enough money. They're typically middle-aged. They have decent income, and they mm-hmm. they know that this muscle car is going to be a bit of a toy. But they want to enjoy it. But they don't have a lot of, they may not have a place to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have a lot of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
To them, I want to speak mostly.
Okay, good.
These people need to buy a finished or nearly finished car. They need to buy a car that's been either completely restored,
wow.
or if it's an original car that's been used all along, it needs to be something that's been driven all along and maintained.
Right.
Not something that has been sitting in a garage for 20 years. There's a big movement about original cars, original paint, matching numbers. Matching numbers meaning that it's the original engine and transmission that came with the car.
Pretty important to the people who really care about that stuff.
Well, yeah, but that goes back to the first category, the guy who wants to have the showpiece.
Exactly, the period piece. You
sure.
know?
That second person that wants to drive and enjoy this car, they're not really going to benefit from a car that's been sitting. Yes, it's original paint, it's matching numbers. What that means is it's an old car.
Mm.
It still has all its original wiring, original everything. And that's not good. It's not going to encourage and help the ownership experience.
It's too much for them to handle.
Absolutely. Now, if they want to learn by restoring a car, that's different. But that's not who we're talking about. We're talking about the person who wants to buy the car and have the ownership experience begin right away. They want to jump in, turn the key, and drive.
Right.
Restored, finished cars are the way to go.
You said there was like a different value level, 50%, or, you know, you had to, what was the, how much you had to
Well, yeah,
spend
typically,
on?
Typically what we find in the industry is that finished cars are available for sale for a fraction of what has been originally invested in it. it's not unusual to see, we'll use a 69 Camaro as an example. A properly restored 69 Camaro will cost the restorer 50, 60, can be upwards of $100,000 to properly restore that car. Once that car's been restored, it's been enjoyed by its owner, now he wants to sell it and get something else. He's not going to get his investment back. He's going to be selling that car for half of what it's in it, which is a huge value for that person looking to jump into something and drive it right away. One of the things that I want to caution everybody listening to me about right now is the idea that buying a half-finished, incomplete project is a good value. If you're not experienced in automotive repair,
yes,
buying someone else's unfinished project can be an absolute nightmare. You do not know what they've done. They're not able to demonstrate the car. You're not able to drive it. You don't know necessarily if it runs. There can be some terrible surprises down the road.
Right.
And I've been through that myself and a number of my friends.
You know about it. You've been doing this stuff for years.
Sure. And you end up having to take the car back apart and start over again. And remember, we're talking about the person who's working 9 to 5 and may have children. They don't have time to come home from work and rebuild their muscle car. What they want is to go out and get a gallon of milk. They want to put the top down and drive it. So
right.
They need to buy a finished or nearly finished car, something that the potential seller can demonstrate that this is indeed a reliable, sound platform.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it needs a paint job. Maybe it needs some interior work. And that we get a lot of those. We'll get a lot of cars because that's what we mostly do is auto interior and
sure.
convertible top work. Will the potential show car sometimes falls short because the restorer may run out of money
mm-hmm.
or he loses interest. The interior, the tops, some of the chrome trim, that's pretty much the last stuff. And oftentimes those parts have been left out, and then the car changes hands, and then it ends up in my shop.
Right. What you were saying earlier, though, the best thing to do, another piece of advice that you wanted to give, was to come by your place first, because you're the upholstery guy, so it's best to stop by there first.
Absolutely. I enjoy
Before anything else is done.
Sure.
First stop, I'm restoring my car. Go to GS Upholstery. Right?
I don't mind it when people just call me and they say, hey, I'm looking at a 19 whatever, and I'm wondering what your feelings are on this. If they've already bought the car, then I would like for them to bring it by. Here's what I'm thinking about. They'll call me and they'll say, it needs an interior. It needs a top. Or I'll get the person who is beginning a restoration and they're not sure how to proceed. Even though my shop doesn't offer full restoration services, I enjoy an ability, and I've been around this stuff for my entire life, and I can tell someone how to proceed step by step to do a proper restoration. Just because you don't offer all the services, you can certainly offer the guidance. And oftentimes that works out for us because in the end, when they're all finished up and they're ready for that interior and that top, that restored car ends up in my shop.
Right, sure.
And it feels great. They say, you know, Gil, you've been with us the whole way. We came here 2 years ago and you told us what to do first. And it's really neat. I've been a part of a lot of restorations.
Yes. And incredible amount of restorations, some of which are pictured on your website, gsautoupholstery.com. And some of the pictures actually we're going to download on the radio station's website as well for users. But we, you know, one of the things we wanted to do when we talked about with you is coming back and sharing some more details, you know, some detailed tips, maybe going through the process with us on fixing up cars, maybe bringing in some of your network in, talking about what's going on in the, you know, in the area, some more, you know, the slice of the Dairy Queen and what's going, you know, what's happening there, you know, and new developments in that.
Sure.
Yeah, just, you know, I find this whole thing very interesting. And, you know, I mean, for instance, one thing you mentioned was the ethanol.
Sure. The new fuels have a lot of ethanol in them. And
okay.
It's well known that these fuels are not very stable and that over time they break down.
Right.
There are a number of products on the market that are, one of them being, I believe it's called Stable, and you're supposed to add it to your gas tank so that your fuel doesn't go bad. And because the problem is, these people will be storing these cars, even if you drive it once a week. You're going to drive it on the weekends. Well, it takes a while to use up that 20 gallons of fuel that's in that gas tank.
Uh-huh.
It may take 6 months. And I'm here to tell you through experience, at the end of that 6 months, that car's not going to run the way it did before.
Right.
That fuel's going to be gumming up the carburetor and causing some serious problems. People need to realize on these older cars, and new cars as well, that they need to maintain the fuel system. New cars, it's not necessarily as much of a problem because you're burning up that fuel every day. You get in and drive that car to work.
Right.
These cars are sitting in a garage. Absolutely look into a fuel stabilizer.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, do you have any other types of general tips that you wanted to talk about today?
Sure.
Or, you know?
Absolutely. I think that there's a lot more ways to enjoy your muscle car on a weekly basis. There are a number of neighborhood hangouts, if you
right.
will.
That's what we're talking about, that slice of Americana.
Absolutely. You know? There's one in Bowie that's wonderful. It's at the Glory Days Grill.
Okay.
At the Bowie Shopping Center on Route 450. It's right across from the firehouse. There are a number of these get-togethers in the Glen Burnie, Pasadena area.
Right, and that's what Baltimore is all about.
Sure, and it's wonderful, Ray, because it's almost like they're there for you. They're there waiting for you. You pull up in your muscle car,
uh-huh.
they're happy to see you.
Right.
You get that gratification. You've gone
right.
to the, it's a bit of an effort. You come home from work, you're tired, you're dirty.
Okay.
You're going to eat your dinner, you're going to get in your car, and you're going to make that trip out to that gathering. And there they are, and they want you there. The more, the merrier. It's a great thing. It feeds on itself.
Right. I mean, it's so much fun. And also, I think you were mentioning, too, that it's a good thing for someone who's getting involved in the restoration movement to go to these things and actually ask questions and talk about, you know, what kind of engine you're using. And, you know, and that way you learn about, you know, what you're doing as well.
Ray, I have learned through the years that any car show you go to, 99% of the owners of those cars love to talk about their cars.
Right, okay.
They're waiting for someone to come up and talk to them.
Yes.
You'll find that across the board. There's the 1% that's very private. Perhaps they're just shy. People love for you to come up and say, hey, that's a beautiful car. What did you do to it? Did you buy it that way? Who painted it? These people are they love to tell you about it, and they love to help you.
Right.
And I do as well.
Right. No, it's a very welcoming community. And once you join, you feel you're part of a family.
You betcha.
A family, American tradition, a great American tradition. One thing I wanted to tell you about is, we were talking about this, is one place I want to share with you, and actually, your son Tommy, who's here today, by the way. Sorry, Tommy. Yeah. Tommy's here with his father, Gil, and it's very much of a family business. You know, Tommy's been working in the shop and you know, it's just carrying on that tradition from one generation to the next.
He was working with us today before we came up here.
Right. So he's come up today to visit us at the Baltimore Internet Radio. But also, Gil and Tommy, one of the things we wanted, me and Janice, my wife, want to take you to is Benji's Drive-In. And I know you've never been there before. It's north of Baltimore. It's in the Baltimore suburbs. And it is very, oh, there's one of those cars coming right back right now. You can hear
it. I do. I hear it right out the window.
But no, it is the slice, a small slice of the classic car movement, because they, right in the middle, they have all these restored old cars at Benji's Drive-In. They've got all the paraphernalia about the old days everywhere. And, you know, not only that, but just kind of like an old slice of Americana where you're, you know, you get to go to the drive-in and you've got the old fashioned, just the newsstands are better, you know, of course, but you still got the old ones sitting there. And everybody goes and enjoys themselves and eats and, you know, and so.
It's a real family-friendly atmosphere.
Yes, yes, yes. So,
you know, yeah. I'm sure that 20, 30 years ago, a gathering of hot rods was not something that the typical mother and father would want to take their children to.
Right.
They maybe likened it to a Hell's Angels kind of a thing.
Right.
Which nowadays, it couldn't be further from the truth. Every car gathering, even at the racetrack, is very family-friendly. It's family-oriented. And there's a reason for that, Ray. The reason is everyone's selling these parts. These auto parts industries, that's big, big money. And they see my son Tommy, who just turned 15, and they look at him and they know that there is a potential buyer of their parts standing there.
Right. A future guy that's going to be, you know, involved with the car movement. My nephew's very involved in the car movement. He has this car membership, thecarcommunity.com. And, you know, it's neat to see them talk about their new cars and how similar they are to, you know, the old cars. But they also, you know, their membership also includes the classic car enthusiasts. So that's kind of cool to see that next generation, you know, picking up the mantle there. You know?
Absolutely, and I think that there's a more of an adult approach to it these days. I think it's well funded. These car shows, these gatherings you go to, they're orderly, they're neat, they're clean. It's not a rowdy, dangerous atmosphere. It's a bunch of people that they're with their families and they care about the cars.
Southern Maryland's big into this too. I mean, you know, I'm always hearing so it's, you know, it's Baltimore, it's Southern Maryland, it's Maryland, you know, it's all over the place. My old boss used to race in the old Capitol Raceway. Years ago he had one of those, the, you know, dragsters.
Sure.
He was, you know, my old boss Dick Fleski, and I was a building engineer, he was my boss. And he had a lot of pictures on the wall, you know. And so it's great to hear that these places are, you know, are experiencing this resurgence and that they become, you know, restored and they're popular. I must admit, it's been a number of years since I've been to one of these events, but it makes me want to go back.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. You know, it's funny, Ray, that you would think that anybody involved with the automotive industry as a job, they're there to make money, and that's really not the case. I've experienced a number of individuals who, granted, they're very well off, and they probably don't need to work a day in their lives after they're done, and they're finished working. But they're willing to provide places to have these car shows. They provide all the funding, and they're doing it because they love the muscle car.
Right.
It's wonderful to watch that. What passion.
Yes, what passion. And it's always part of the county fair process, too. You know, I remember throughout Maryland, you know, going to the place over off of George Avenue, and I think it's 97, there's a big county fair out there. I remember looking at these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun. And, you know, it's great to get the next generation involved and to see it's thriving. And
do you know, Ray, you know that even the motor vehicle administrations across the country have embraced all of this?
They
offer special tags, the historic tags, the street rod tags, the insurance companies that have popped up because they know you're not going to drive your car every day, and they give you special rates. Everybody is about this muscle car movement.
Great. You know, something that's a great future guest, if you'd like to, you know, do a show, come back you know, or come back on my scoop. But like, for instance, somebody from the NVA that's a part of that effort. You know, they're always glad to come down and talk about those things. But you know, mm-hmm. also people you work with, right across the street. I'm going to point out is hold on, folks. East Baltimore Car Care, and that place has been in the movie theaters. I think it was on one of the scenes in Avalon, but it's been there for years as a center of Main Street, you know, where people come and go. The guy who owns this place, he's recently retired, was my buddy Joe from Lithuania. Yeah, and I used to get together with him, and you probably know him from a few years back when we were hanging around. Back then, it was called Backstreets.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know, him and Jerry over right over there in the corner. You know, I mean,
yeah, I remember the tires. The owner of Backstreet Pub had. He was very fond of Mopars. He had a lot of Hemi cars. Actually.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he did.
Oh, that's Roger. Roger Belinda.
Roger, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Right down the street.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's funny that gives you a common ground. You can walk into a room and you don't know anybody. And you just say Camaro or race car, muscle car, and there's going to be somebody in that room who wants to talk to you. It gives you common ground anywhere.
My old friend, and you might even know him, and we call him, Bitchin' Steve. And that's because he had a Bitchin' Camaro when he was younger. So we still call him that.
Sure.
You know? So anyway, I don't know if we're going to get in trouble with the FCC over that, but I'll have to discuss that with Dave later.
You know, this whole passion with the cars, as far as I know, happened when all the World War II soldiers were coming home.
Okay.
And they wanted to start, you know, it sounds a little nerdy, but they wanted to have speed contests. Of course, it happened before the Second World War. There was the Indianapolis 500 started in the early 1900s. But the mainstream average Joe, I just want to have a little fun with my car, it really seemed to take seed after the Second World War.
See, and that's a whole new show that we could talk about the history of that. I mean, and I remember that moment with Henry Ford, that classic race in which, I don't know if you heard about that, but Henry Ford managed to break the engine monopoly, by raising cash when he raced the existing car at the time, and he won. And by that momentum and that fame, he managed to break the car industry and start producing cars on a massive scale.
Right. And it's funny how Detroit historically has followed the automotive enthusiasts and given them what they wanted. Right. Let's look back to the early 60s. This soldiers had come home from the Second World War. They were hopping up the Model A's and the Model T's from the 20s and 30s. And in the early 60s,
by the 60s is
sure. But they started to take notice that there were more and more people who wanted a faster car. And in the late 50s, early 60s, Detroit responded. And that was the pony car and muscle car beginnings.
What about the motorcycles, too? Because I remember after World War II, like all these guys were driving motorcycles and creating gangs in the 50s.
But look what's happening now. 40 years later, it's happening again with the cars that you were talking about, the new Challengers, the new Camaros, the new muscle cars. Detroit has been watching, and they're providing the cars that people want.
And finally, they could sell internationally, something they could sell internationally, because the years that formula was missing, I think. I would go traveling a bit, and you know, it didn't seem like American cars were catching on internationally. I'm wondering if that has caught on now. So maybe that's another subject we could explore.
Yeah, because my understanding is that's a huge business. The people over in Europe are buying the American cars. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, that's great. That's great news to hear.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's certainly reducing the amount of original old muscle cars that are in the States.
Ah.
They're going over to Europe by the hundreds, if not thousands.
Oh, no. So that now the muscle cars are becoming, you know, kind of rare.
Yes, but then they're in, let's say, they're in Switzerland, and you see that car on the internet. Well, you can have it brought back to the States. It really goes back again to the internet, makes the world a much smaller place.
Oh, that's true.
So the Detroit Iron hasn't necessarily been lost forever.
Wow, that's neat. That's real neat. Great. Fantastic. You know, it's been so much fun talking to you today. Thank you so much for stopping by my scoop. Oh, let's ask you for your info. You know, I'll give you a chance to where your shop's at, you know, address, you know, phone number.
Sure.
Website again.
Again, my name is Gil Spurlett. I am the owner of GS Auto Upholstery. It's located at 1027 Benfield Boulevard in Millersville, Maryland. The zip code is 21108. Our website is gsautoupholstery.com, and our phone number, very easy to remember, 410-987-TRIM. That's 987-8746.
You know, and it's such a great place, once I really emphasize, it's such a great place just to even stop by and ask a question and hang out, you know, preferably at the end of the day if you want to just hang out.
Absolutely.
You know, and just kind of get involved in the local restoration movement or fixing up fairly new cars that are becoming classic as well.
There's
which
always
is my Toyota, actually. My Toyota Celica, right? Which is a convertible.
Right.
It would be talked about that. You know, you fix it. You always put the new tops on. You always, like, you know, you always taking care of my cars over the years. And you always gave me, you know, great advice. And, you know, it's always friendly service. But we're talking about the fact that my car is becoming classic now. What is that, though? It's, I don't even know what year it was.
I think it's 97.
97. Sure. And it was the last year that the Toyota Celica had a convertible. And it's just a nice car. So I might be restoring it pretty soon and, you know, stopping by there. So
there's always something neat in my shop. There's always a reason to stop by. Even if it's just one or two, there's always something unique. That shop has a pulse, I swear.
Yeah, it does. It's amazing, you know. So anyway, thank you, Gil. Thank you, Tommy, for stopping by. And listeners, I hope you tune in next week for some more interesting, hopefully you find interesting subject matter, neighborhood subject matter. And hopefully tune in the future for Mr. Spurlett coming back and talking more about the car movement in Baltimore. Thank you, and have a good evening.